you would suffocate. But there is something even more disturbing. Your blood would boil. At sea level, water boils at 212 degrees Fahrenheit, or 100 degrees Celsius. The boiling point of water drops as atmospheric pressure drops. As a child, I had a vivid demonstration of this principle one day, while camping in the mountains. We were frying eggs in a pan over a fire. The eggs, sizzling away in the pan, looked delicious. But when I ate them, I almost threw up. They tasted awful. Then it was pointed out to me that as you climb up a mountain, the atmospheric pressure begins to drop, and the boiling point of water decreases. Although the eggs bubbled and appeared to be fried, they were never completely cooked. The bubbling egg wasn't so hot at all. I had another encounter with this fact when celebrating Christmas as a child. At our house, we had old-fashioned Christmas lights, consisting of thin tubes of water placed vertically on top of each electrical fixture. When we turned them on, they were gorgeous. The brightly colored water in the tubes began to boil in various colors. Then I did something foolish. I grabbed the tubes of boiling water with my bare fingers. I immediately expected to feel the intense heat of boiling water, but I felt almost nothing. Years later, I realized what had happened. Inside the tube was a partial vacuum. As a consequence, the boiling point of water dropped, so even the heat of a small electrical fixture could make the liquid boil, but the boiling water wasn't hot at all. Our astronauts will encounter the same physics if they ever have a leak in their spacesuits in space or on the moon. As the air leaves the suit, the pressure inside drops and the boiling point of water also drops. Eventually, the blood in the astronaut's body will begin to boil. Sitting in our chair here on Earth, we forget that we have almost 15 pounds of air pressure pushing down on every square inch of our skin, because there is a huge column of air sitting right above us. Why aren't we crushed? Because we have 15 pounds of pressure pushing out from inside our body. There is a balance. But if we go to the moon, the 15 pounds of pressure beating down on us from the atmosphere disappears. Then we only have the 15 pounds of pressure pushing outward. In other words, taking off your spacesuit on the moon could be a very unpleasant experience. Best to keep it on at all times. What might a permanent moon base look like? Unfortunately, NASA has not issued any formal blueprints, so all we have are the imaginations of science fiction authors and Hollywood scriptwriters as rough guides. But once a lunar base is constructed, we would endeavor to make it totally self-sustaining. Such a system would vastly lower costs, but it would require a great deal of infrastructure. Factories to create buildings, large greenhouses for food, chemical plants to create oxygen, and huge solar banks for energy. To pay for all of this, one would need a source of income. Since the moon is largely made of the same material as the Earth, we may need to look beyond it for a revenue stream. That is why Silicon Valley entrepreneurs have already set their sights on the asteroids. There are millions of asteroids in space, and they may be the home of untold riches. Killer asteroids are nature's way of asking, "How's that space program coming along?" Anonymous. Chapter 3. Mining the Heavens. Thomas Jefferson was deeply disturbed. He had just signed over $15 million to Napoleon, a princely sum in 1803, the most controversial and costly decision of his career as president. He had doubled the size of the United States. The country would now extend all the way to the Rocky Mountains. The Louisiana Purchase would go down as one of the biggest successes or failures of his presidency. Looking at the map, with its huge expanse of totally uncharted territory, he wondered if he would regret his decision. Eventually, he would send Meriwether Lewis and William Clark on a mission to explore what he had bought. Was it a wilderness paradise waiting to be colonized, or a desolate wasteland? Privately, he acknowledged that in any event, it might take another 1,000 years to settle such a vast stretch of land. A few decades later, something happened that changed everything. In 1848, gold was discovered at Sutter's Mill in California. The news was electrifying. More than 300,000 people flooded into this wilderness to seek riches. Ships from all over began to line up at San Francisco Harbor. Its economy exploded in size. The next year, California applied for statehood. Farmers, ranchers, and businessmen followed, making possible the formation of some of the first great cities of the West. In 1869, the railroad came to California, connecting it to the rest of the United States and supporting an infrastructure of transportation and commerce that led to rapid population growth in the region. The mantra for the 19th century was, "Go west, young man." The gold rush, for all its excesses, helped to open up the West for settlement and make all this happen. Today, some are wondering whether the mining of the asteroid belt could create another gold rush in outer space. Already, private entrepreneurs have expressed an interest in exploring this region and its untold riches. And NASA has funded several missions with the goal of bringing an asteroid back to Earth. Could the next great expansion be in the asteroid belt? And if so, how might we incorporate and sustain this new space economy? One can envision a potential analogy between the agricultural supply chain of the 19th century Wild West and a future supply chain involving the asteroids. In the 1800s, teams of cowboys would herd cattle from ranches in the Southwest, almost 1,000 miles toward cities like Chicago. There, the beef would be processed and sent farther east by train to satisfy demand in urban areas. In the same way that these early cattle drives connected the Southwest to the Northeast, perhaps an economy could arise connecting the asteroid belt to the moon and the Earth. The moon would be like the Chicago of the future, processing valuable minerals from the asteroid belt and shipping them on to Earth. Origin of the asteroid belt. Before we delve further into the details of asteroid mining, it may be helpful to clarify a few terms that are often confused with one another. Meteor, meteorite, asteroid, and comet. A meteor is a piece of rock that burns up in the atmosphere as it streaks across the sky. The tails of meteors, which point away from the direction of motion, are caused by air friction. On a clear night, you might see a meteor every few minutes simply by gazing upward. A rock that actually lands on Earth is called a meteorite. Asteroids are rocky debris in the solar system. Most of them are contained in the asteroid belt and are remnants of a failed planet between Mars and Jupiter. If you were to add up the masses of all the known asteroids, the sum would only amount to 4% of the mass of the moon. However, the majority of these objects have not yet been detected by us, and there are potentially billions of them. For the most part, asteroids remain in stable orbits in the asteroid belt. But occasionally, one strays and hits the Earth's atmosphere and burns up as a meteor. A comet is a piece of ice and rock that originates far beyond the orbit of the Earth. While asteroids lie within the solar system, many comets actually orbit in the outer fringes of the solar system, in the Kuiper Belt, or even outside the solar system itself, in the Oort cloud. The comets we see in the night sky are those whose orbit or trajectory has brought them near the sun. When comets approach the sun, solar wind pushes particles of ice and dust away from the comet, resulting in tails that point away from the sun, not away from the direction of motion. Over the years, a picture has emerged of how our solar system was formed. About 5 billion years ago, our sun was a slowly spinning gigantic cloud, mainly made of hydrogen and helium gas and dust. It was several light years across. A light year is the distance light travels in 1 year, or about 6 trillion miles. Because of its large mass, it was gradually compressed by gravity. As it shrank in size, it rotated faster and faster, just as skaters spin faster when they bring their arms in. Eventually, the cloud condensed into a rapidly rotating disk, with the sun at its center. The surrounding disk of gas and dust began to form protoplanets, which got larger as they continued to absorb material. This process explains why all the planets revolve around the sun in the same direction, in the same plane. It is believed that one of these protoplanets got too close to Jupiter, the largest of the planets, and was ripped apart by its enormous gravity, thereby forming the asteroid belt. Another theory suggests that the collision of two protoplanets may have resulted in the asteroid belt. The solar system can be pictured as four belts orbiting the sun. The innermost belt is made up of the rocky planets, which include Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. Next is the asteroid belt. Beyond that is the gas giant belt, consisting of Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And finally, the comet belt, also called the Kuiper belt. And outside these four belts, we have a spherical cloud of comets surrounding the solar system called the Oort cloud. Water, a simple molecule, was a common substance in the early solar system, but occurred in different forms depending on its distance from the sun. Close to the sun, where water would boil and turn to steam, we find the planets Mercury and Venus. The Earth is farther out, so that water can exist in liquid form. This is sometimes called the Goldilocks zone, where the temperature is right for liquid water to exist. Beyond that, water turns to ice. So Mars and the planets and comets beyond that mainly have water in frozen form. Mining the asteroids. Understanding the origin of asteroids, and therefore their composition, will be crucial for mining operations. The idea of mining asteroids is not as preposterous as it might seem. We actually know a considerable amount about their makeup, because some of them hit the Earth. They consist of iron, nickel, carbon, and cobalt. And they also contain significant quantities of rare earths and valuable metals, such as platinum, palladium, rhodium, ruthenium, iridium, and osmium. These elements are found naturally on Earth, but they are rare and very expensive. As the supply of these resources on Earth is exhausted in the coming decades, it will become economical to mine them in the asteroid belt. And if an asteroid is nudged so that it orbits the moon, it can be mined at will. In 2012, a group of entrepreneurs established a company called Planetary Resources to extract valuable minerals from asteroids and bring them back to Earth. This ambitious and potentially highly lucrative plan was backed by some of the biggest players in Silicon Valley, including Larry Page, CEO of Google's parent company, Alphabet Inc., and executive chairman Eric Schmidt, as well as Oscar-winning director James Cameron. Asteroids, in some sense, are like flying gold mines in outer space. For example, in July 2015, one came within 1 million miles of Earth, or about 4 times the distance from the Earth to the Moon. It was about 900 meters, or about 3,000 feet, across, and was estimated to contain 90 million tons of platinum in its core, worth $5.4 trillion. Planetary Resources estimates that the platinum within a mere 30-meter asteroid could be worth $25 to $50 billion. The company has gone so far as to make a list of small nearby asteroids that are ripe for the taking. If any one of these were to be successfully brought back to Earth, it would contain a motherload of minerals that would pay back its investors manyfold. Out of the 16,000 or so asteroids considered near-Earth objects, those whose orbits cross the Earth's path, astronomers identified their own roster of 12 that would make ideal candidates for retrieval. Calculations have shown that these 12, each between 10 and 70 feet across, can be coaxed into lunar or Earth orbit with a gentle shift in their trajectories. But there are many others out there. In January 2017, a new asteroid was unexpectedly detected by astronomers just hours before it whizzed by. It passed a mere 32,000 miles from Earth, or 13% of the distance from the Earth to the Moon. Fortunately, it was only 20 feet across and would not have caused significant damage if it had hit us. However, it did provide further confirmation of the great number of asteroids that drift past the Earth, most of them undetected. Exploring the asteroids. Asteroids are so important that NASA has targeted the exploration of them as the first step toward a Mars mission. In 2012, a few months after Planetary Resources unveiled its plan at a press conference, NASA announced the Robotic Asteroid Prospector Project, which will analyze the feasibility of mining them. Then, in the fall of 2016, NASA launched a billion-dollar probe called OSIRIS-REx to meet Bennu, an asteroid measuring 1,600 feet across that will pass the Earth in 2135. By 2018, the probe will circle Bennu, land on it, and then bring back between 2 and 70 ounces of rock to Earth for analysis. This plan is not without risk, as NASA fears that even slight perturbations in the orbit of Bennu might cause it to hit the Earth on its next pass. If it does strike the Earth, it would do so with the force of 1,000 Hiroshima bombs. This mission, however, could provide invaluable experience in intercepting and analyzing objects in space. NASA is also developing the Asteroid Redirect Mission, ARM, which aims to actually retrieve asteroid boulders from space. Funding is not guaranteed, but the hope is that the mission could open up a new source of revenue for the space program. The ARM has two stages. First, an unmanned probe would be sent into deep space to intercept an asteroid that has been carefully evaluated by Earth-based telescopes. After conducting a detailed survey of the surface, it would land and use pincer-like hooks to grab onto a large boulder. The probe then would blast off and head to the Moon, dragging the object by a tether. At that point, a manned mission would leave Earth, using the SLS rocket with the Orion module. The module would dock with the robotic probe as they both orbit the Moon. Astronauts would leave the Orion, access the probe, and extract samples for analysis. Finally, the Orion space module would separate from the robotic probe and head back to Earth, splashing down in the ocean. One possible complication to this mission is that we don't yet know much about the physical structure of asteroids. They may be solid, or they may be a collection of smaller rocks held together by gravity, in which case they would fall apart if we tried to land on them. For this reason, further investigation is needed before this mission can proceed. One notable physical feature of asteroids is their highly irregular shape. They often look like deformed potatoes, and the smaller they are, the more irregular they tend to be. This, in turn, raises a question that children often ask. Why are stars, the sun, and the planets all round? Why can't stars and planets be shaped like cubes or pyramids? While small asteroids have little mass and hence little gravity to reshape them, large objects like planets and stars have huge gravitational fields, This gravity is uniform and attractive, and hence will compress an irregularly shaped object into a sphere. So the planets, billions of years ago, were not necessarily round, but over time, the attractive force of gravity compressed them into smooth spheres. Another question often raised by children is why space probes aren't destroyed when they go through the asteroid belt. In the movie Star Wars, our heroes are almost hit by the huge chunks of rock flying around. While the Hollywood portrayal is thrilling, fortunately, it does not truly represent the density of the asteroid belt, which is mainly an empty vacuum with occasional rocks passing by. Future miners and settlers who brave outer space in search of new lands will, for the most part, find the asteroid belt relatively easy to navigate. If these stages of asteroid exploration proceed according to plan, the final goal will be to create a permanent station to maintain, resupply, and support future missions. Ceres, the largest of the objects in the belt, might make an ideal base of operations. Ceres, whose name comes from the Greek goddess of agriculture, which also gives us the word cereal, was recently reclassified as a dwarf planet, like Pluto, and is thought to be an object that never quite accumulated enough matter to rival its planetary neighbors. For a celestial object, it is small, about a quarter of the size of the moon, with no atmosphere and little gravity. However, for an asteroid, it is huge. It is about 580 miles across, or roughly the size of Texas, and contains one-third of the total mass of the entire asteroid belt. Given its weak gravity, it might make an ideal space station, as rockets would easily be able to land and leave the asteroid, which are important factors in building a spaceport. NASA's Dawn mission, launched in 2007 and orbiting around Ceres since 2015, revealed a spherical but heavily cratered mass, made primarily of ice and rock. It is theorized that many asteroids, like Ceres, contain ice, which could be processed to extract hydrogen and oxygen for fuel. Recently, using NASA's infrared telescope facility, scientists observed that the asteroid 24 Themis was completely covered in ice, with traces of organic chemicals on the surface. These findings add validity to the conjecture that asteroids and comets may have brought some of the original water and amino acids to the Earth billions of years ago. Because asteroids are small compared to moons and planets, they probably will not evolve into permanent cities for colonists. To create a stable community in the asteroid belt would be difficult. For the most part, there is no air to breathe, water to drink, energy to consume, or soil in which to grow food, and there is no gravity to speak of. Thus, asteroids will more likely become temporary quarters for miners and robots. But they may prove to be an essential staging area for the main event, a manned mission to Mars. Mars is there, waiting to be reached. Buzz Aldrin. I would like to die on Mars, just not on impact. Elon Musk. Chapter 4, Mars or Bust. Elon Musk is a bit of a maverick, an entrepreneur with a cosmic mission, to build the rockets that one day will take us to Mars. Tsiolkovsky, Goddard, and von Braun all dreamed of going to Mars, but Musk may actually do it. In the process, he is breaking all the rules of the game. He fell in love with the space program as a child, growing up in South Africa, and even built a rocket on his own. His father, an engineer, encouraged his interests. Early on, Musk concluded that the risk of human extinction could only be avoided by reaching for the stars. And so he decided that one of his goals would be making life multiplanetary, a theme that has guided his entire career. In addition to rocketry, he was compelled by two other passions, computers and business. He was programming at the age of 10 and sold his first video game called Blaster for $500 at the age of 12. He was restless and hoped one day to move to America. When he was 17, he emigrated to Canada on his own. By the time he received his bachelor's degree in physics from the University of Pennsylvania, he was torn between two possible careers. One path led to the life of a physicist or engineer, designing rockets or other high-tech devices. The other led to business and the use of his computer skills to amass a fortune, which would give him the means to bankroll his vision privately. The dilemma came to a head when he began his PhD studies at Stanford University in 1995 in applied physics. After spending just 2 days in the program, he abruptly dropped out and plunged into the world of internet startups. He borrowed $28,000 and founded a software company that produced an online city guide for the newspaper publishing industry. He sold it to Compaq for $341 million 4 years later. He netted $22 million from that sale and immediately plowed the profits into a new company called X.com, which would evolve into PayPal. In 2002, eBay bought PayPal for $1.5 billion, from which Musk received $165 million. Flush with cash, he harnessed these funds to fulfill his dreams, creating SpaceX and Tesla Motors. At one point, he invested 90% of his entire net worth in his two companies. Unlike other aerospace companies, which build rockets based on known technology, SpaceX pioneered a revolutionary design for a reusable rocket. Musk's goal was to reduce the cost of space travel by a factor of 10 by reusing the booster, which is normally discarded after each launch. Almost from scratch, Musk developed the Falcon, named after the Millennium Falcon from Star Wars, which would boost a space module called the Dragon, named after the song Puff the Magic Dragon, into outer space. In 2012, SpaceX's Falcon rocket made history by being the first commercial rocket to reach the International Space Station. It also became the first rocket to land successfully back on Earth after an orbital flight. His first wife, Justine Musk, says, "I like to compare him to the Terminator. He sets his program and just will not stop." In 2017, he scored another major victory when he successfully relaunched a used booster rocket. The previously launched rocket had landed back on its launch pad, been cleaned up and serviced, and was sent up a second time. Reusability may revolutionize the economics of space travel. Think of the used car market. After World War II, cars were still out of reach for many people, especially GIs and the young. The used car industry enabled average consumers to purchase cars and changed everything, including our lifestyles and social interactions. Today, in the United States, about 40 million used cars are sold every year, which is 2.2 times the number of new cars sold. In the same way, Musk hopes that his Falcon rocket will transform the aerospace market and allow rocket prices to plunge. Most organizations will not care if the rocket that sends its satellite into outer space is brand new or previously used. They will opt for the cheapest, most reliable method. The first reusable rocket was a milestone. But Musk shocked audiences when he laid out the details of his ambitious plans to reach Mars. He expects to send an unmanned mission to Mars in 2018, followed by a manned mission by 2024, beating NASA by about a decade. His ultimate aim is to establish not just an outpost, but a whole city on Mars. He imagines sending a fleet of 1,000 modified Falcon rockets, each carrying 100 colonists, to create the first settlement on the Red Planet. The keys to Musk's plan are the dramatically falling cost of space travel and new innovations. Calculations of the price of a Mars mission usually range between $400 to $500 billion. But Musk estimates that he can create and launch the Mars rocket for only $10 billion. At first, tickets to Mars would be expensive, but they would eventually drop to about $200,000 per person round trip because of the falling price of space travel. This is comparable to the $200,000 necessary to ride just 70 miles above the Earth on Virgin Galactic's Spaceship Two, or the $20 to $40 million estimated price of a trip to the International Space Station on a Russian rocket. Musk's proposed rocket system was originally called the Mars Colonial Transporter, but he renamed it the Interplanetary Transport System because, as he said, this system really gives you freedom to go anywhere you want in the greater solar system. His long-term vision is to build a network that would connect the planets as the railroad connected American cities. Musk sees potential for collaboration with other parts of his multi-billion dollar empire. Tesla has developed an advanced version of the fully electric car, and Musk is heavily invested in solar energy, which would be the primary source of power for any Martian outpost. Therefore, Musk is in an ideal position to supply the electrical machinery and solar arrays required to advance a Mars colony. While NASA is often painfully slow and sluggish, entrepreneurs believe they can introduce fresh, innovative ideas and techniques quickly. There's a silly notion that failure's not an option at NASA, Musk said. Failure is an option here at SpaceX. If things are not failing, you are not innovating enough. Musk is perhaps the contemporary face of the space program. Brash, fearless, and iconoclastic, in addition to being innovative and smart. He is a new kind of rocket scientist, the entrepreneur billionaire scientist. He is often compared to Tony Stark, the alter ego of Iron Man, a suave industrialist and inventor who is at home with business tycoons and engineers alike. As a matter of fact, part of the first sequel to Iron Man was filmed at the SpaceX headquarters in Los Angeles. And when visitors drive up to SpaceX, they are greeted with a life-size statue of Tony Stark in his Iron Man suit. Musk even influenced a space-themed runway collection at New York Fashion Week by menswear designer Nick Graham, who explained, "They say Mars is the new black. It's incredibly top-of-the-mind trending in terms of everyone's ambitions. The idea was to show the fall 2025 collection based on the year Elon Musk wants to get the first people on Mars." Musk summed up his philosophy by saying, "I really don't have any other motivation for personally accumulating assets," he said, "except to be able to make the biggest contribution I can to making life multiplanetary." Peter Diamandis of the XPRIZE has said, "There's a much bigger driver here than just profitability. Musk's vision is intoxicating and powerful." New space race to Mars. All this talk about Mars, of course, was bound to stir up rivalry. The CEO of Boeing, Dennis Muilenburg, has said, "I'm convinced that the first person to step foot on Mars will arrive there riding on a Boeing rocket." It was probably no accident that he made these startling remarks 1 week after Musk announced his Mars plans. Musk may be grabbing all the headlines, but Boeing has a long tradition of successful space travel. It was Boeing, after all, that manufactured the booster rocket for the famed Saturn V, which took our astronauts to the moon, and Boeing currently has the contract to build the massive SLS booster rocket, the foundation of NASA's planned mission to Mars. Supporters of NASA have pointed out that public funding was crucial for major space projects of the past, such as the Hubble Space Telescope, one of the jewels of the space program. Would private investors have funded such a risky endeavor with no hope of generating returns for stockholders? The backing of large bureaucratic organizations may be necessary for ventures that are too expensive for private enterprise or have little hope of generating revenue. There are advantages to each of these competing programs. Boeing's SLS, which can lift 130 metric tons into outer space, can send bigger payloads than Musk's Falcon Heavy, which can carry 64 metric tons. However, the Falcon may be more affordable. At present, SpaceX has the cheapest rates for launching satellites into space at about $1,000 per pound, or 10% of the usual rate for commercial space vehicles. Prices could drop further as SpaceX perfects its reusable rocket technology. NASA has found itself in an enviable position, with two suitors bidding for a plum project. They can, in principle, still decide between the SLS and the Falcon Heavy. When asked about the challenge from Boeing, Musk said, "I think it's good for there to be multiple paths to Mars, to have multiple irons in the fire. You know, the more, the better." NASA spokesmen have said, "NASA applauds all those who want to take the next giant leap and advance the journey to Mars. This journey will require the best and the brightest. At NASA, we've worked hard over the past several years to develop a sustainable Mars exploration plan and to build a coalition of international and private sector partners to support this vision. In the end, the spirit of competition will likely prove an asset for the space program." There is some poetic justice to this contest, however. The space program, by forcing the miniaturization of electronics, opened the doors to the computer revolution. Inspired by their childhood memories of the space program, the billionaires created by the computer revolution are coming full circle and putting some of their wealth back into space exploration. The Europeans, Chinese, and Russians have also expressed a desire to send a manned mission to Mars in the 2040 to 2060 timeframe, but funding for these projects remains problematic. It is fairly certain, however, that the Chinese will reach the moon in 2025. Chairman Mao once lamented that China was so backward it could not launch a potato into space. Things have changed completely since then. Improving on rockets bought from Russia in the 1990s, China has already launched 10 Tychonauts into orbit and is proceeding with ambitious plans to construct a space station and develop a rocket as powerful as the Saturn V by 2020. In its various five-year plans, China is carefully following the steps pioneered by the Russians and the United States. Even the most hopeful visionaries are fully aware that there will be a host of dangers facing astronauts on a Martian journey. Musk, when asked whether he would personally like to visit Mars, acknowledged that the probability of dying on the first trip to the planet is quite high, and said that he would like to see his children grow up. Space travel is no Sunday picnic. The list of the potential hazards of a manned mission to Mars is formidable. The first is catastrophic failure. We are more than 50 years into the space age, yet the probability of a disastrous rocket accident is still around 1%. There are hundreds of moving parts inside a rocket, and any one of them may cause a mission to fail. The space shuttle had two horrendous accidents out of a total of 135 launches, or about a 1.5% failure rate. The overall fatality rate of the space program has been 3.3%. Of the 544 people who have ever been in space, 18 have died. Only the very courageous are willing to sit on top of 1 million pounds of rocket fuel to be blasted into space at 25,000 miles per hour, not knowing if they are coming back. There is also the Mars jinx. 3/4 or so of our space probes sent to Mars never make it there at all, mainly because of the vast distance, problems with radiation, mechanical failure, loss of communication, micrometeors, etc. Even so, the United States has a much better track record in this regard than the Russians, who have suffered 14 failed attempts to reach the Red Planet. Another issue is the length of the journey to Mars. Going to the moon with the Apollo program only took 3 days, but a one-way voyage to Mars will take upward of 9 months, and a complete round trip will take roughly 2 years. I once toured the NASA Training Center outside Cleveland, Ohio, where teams of scientists analyzed the stresses of space travel. Astronauts suffer from muscle and bone atrophy caused by weightlessness when they spend extended periods in outer space. Our bodies are fine-tuned to live on a planet with the gravity of Earth. If the Earth were even a few percentage points larger or smaller, our bodies would have to be redesigned to survive on it. The longer we are in outer space, the more our bodies deteriorate. Russian astronaut Valery Polyakov, after setting a world record for being in space for 437 days, could barely crawl out of his space capsule when he returned. An interesting fact is that astronauts become several inches taller in outer space due to the expansion of their spinal columns. Once back on Earth, their height reverts back to normal. Astronauts may also lose 1% of their bone mass per month in space. To slow down this loss, they have to exercise at least 2 hours a day on a treadmill. Still, it could take astronauts a full year to rehabilitate after a 6-month tour on the International Space Station, and sometimes they never fully recover their bone mass. A further consequence of weightlessness that wasn't taken seriously until recently is damage to the optic nerve. In the past, astronauts noted that their eyesight deteriorated after long missions in space. Detailed scans of their eyes show that their optic nerves are often inflamed, probably due to pressure from the fluid of the eye. In the future, our space capsules may have to spin so that the centrifugal force can generate artificial gravity. We experience this effect every time we go to a carnival and enter the spinning cylinder of a rotor or gravitron. The centrifugal force produces artificial gravity and pushes us back to the cylinder's wall. At present, a spinning spaceship would be too expensive to produce, and the concept is difficult to execute. The rotating cabin would have to be quite large, or else the centrifugal force would not be evenly distributed, and astronauts would get seasick and disoriented. There is also the problem of radiation in space, especially from the solar wind and cosmic rays. We often forget that the Earth is blanketed by a thick atmosphere and covered with a magnetic field that helps to shield us. At sea level, our atmosphere absorbs most of the deadly radiation. But even on a normal plane ride across the United States, we receive an extra millirem of radiation per hour in the jet, the equivalent of a dental X-ray every time we take a cross-country flight. Astronauts traveling to Mars would have to pass through radiation belts that surround the Earth, which could expose them to heavy doses of radiation and increase their susceptibility to disease, premature aging, and cancer. Being on a 2-year interplanetary trip, an astronaut would receive about 200 times the radiation of a twin who stayed on the Earth. However, this statistic should be placed in context. The astronaut's lifetime risk of developing cancer would rise from 21% to 24%. While not insignificant, this threat pales in comparison to the far greater danger faced by an astronaut from a simple accident or mishap. Cosmic rays from outer space are sometimes so intense that astronauts can actually see tiny flashes of light as subatomic particles ionize the fluid in their eyeballs. I've interviewed several astronauts who have described these flashes, which look beautiful, but can cause serious radiation damage to the eye. And 2016 brought bad news concerning the effects of radiation on the brain. Scientists at the University of California, Irvine, exposed mice to large doses of radiation equivalent to the amount that would be absorbed during a 2-year ride through deep space. They found evidence of irreversible brain damage. The mice showed behavioral problems and became agitated and dysfunctional. At the very least, these results confirm that astronauts must be adequately shielded in deep space. In addition, astronauts have to worry about giant solar flares. In 1972, when Apollo 17 was being readied for a trip to the moon, a powerful solar flare hit the lunar surface. If the astronauts had been walking on the moon at the time, they might have been killed. Unlike cosmic rays, which are random, solar flares can be tracked from the Earth, so it is possible to warn astronauts several hours ahead of time. There have been incidents where the astronauts on the International Space Station were notified of approaching solar flares and ordered to move to better protected sections of the space station. Then there are the micrometeors, which can tear the outer hull of a spacecraft. Close examination of the space shuttle reveals the impact of numerous micrometeorites on its tiled surface. The force of a micrometeor, the size of a postage stamp, traveling at 40,000 miles per hour, would be enough to rip a hole in the rocket and cause rapid depressurization. It may be wise to separate space modules into different chambers, so that a punctured section can be rapidly sealed off from the others. Psychological difficulties will present a different kind of obstacle. Being locked up in a tiny cramped capsule with a small group of people for an extended period of time will be challenging. Even with a battery of psychological tests, we cannot definitively predict how or whether people will cooperate. Ultimately, your life may depend on someone who gets on your nerves. Going to Mars. After months of intense speculation, in 2017, NASA and Boeing finally revealed the details of the plan to reach Mars. Bill Gerstenmaier, of NASA's Human Exploration and Operations Directorate, revealed a surprisingly ambitious timetable for the steps necessary to send our astronauts to the Red Planet. First, after years of testing, the SLS Orion rocket will be launched in 2019. It will be fully automatic, carrying no astronauts, but will orbit the moon. 4 years later, after a 50-year gap, astronauts will finally return to the moon. The mission will last 3 weeks, but it will just orbit around the moon, not land on the lunar surface. This is mainly to test the reliability of the SLS Orion system, rather than to explore the moon. But there is an unexpected twist to NASA's new plan that surprised many analysts. The SLS Orion system is actually a warm-up act. It will serve as the main link by which astronauts will leave the Earth and reach outer space, but an entirely new set of rockets will take us to Mars. First, NASA envisions building the Deep Space Gateway, which resembles the International Space Station, except it is smaller and orbits the Moon, not the Earth. Astronauts will live on the Deep Space Gateway, which will act as a refueling and resupply station for missions to Mars and the asteroids. It will be the basis for a permanent human presence in space. Construction of this lunar space station will begin in 2023, and it will be operational by 2026. 4 SLS missions will be required to build it. But the main act is the actual rocket that will send astronauts to Mars. It is an entirely new system, called the Deep Space Transport, which will be constructed mainly in outer space. In 2029, the Deep Space Transport will have its first major test, circling around the moon for 300 to 400 days. This will provide valuable information about long-term missions in space. Finally, after rigorous testing, the Deep Space Transport will send our astronauts to orbit Mars by 2033. NASA's program has been praised by many experts because it is methodical, with a step-by-step plan to build an elaborate infrastructure on the moon. However, NASA's plan stands in sharp contrast to Musk's vision. NASA's plan is carefully fleshed out and involves the creation of a permanent infrastructure in lunar orbit. But it is slow, perhaps taking a decade longer than Musk's plan. SpaceX bypasses the lunar space station entirely and blasts directly to Mars, perhaps as early as 2022. One drawback, however, of Musk's plan is that the Dragon space capsule is considerably smaller than the Deep Space Transport. Time will tell which approach or combination of approaches is better. First trip to Mars. Because more details are being revealed concerning the first Mars mission, it is now possible to speculate on the steps necessary to reach the Red Planet. Let us trace how NASA's plan may unfold over the next few decades. The first people on the historic mission to Mars are probably alive today, perhaps learning about astronomy in high school. They will be among the hundreds of people who are expected to volunteer for the first mission to another planet. After rigorous training, perhaps 4 candidates will be carefully chosen for their skills and experience, probably including a seasoned pilot, an engineer, a scientist, and a doctor. Sometime around 2033, after a series of anxious interviews with the press, they will finally climb aboard the Orion space capsule. Although the Orion has 50% more room than the original Apollo capsule, things will still be cramped inside. But it doesn't matter, since the trip to the moon will last only 3 days. When the spaceship finally blasts off, they will feel vibrations from the intense burning of rocket fuel from the SLS booster rocket. The entire trip so far looks and feels very similar to the original Apollo mission. But here, the similarity ends. From this point, NASA envisions a radical departure from the past. As they enter lunar orbit, the astronauts will see the Deep Space Gateway, the world's first space station orbiting the moon. The astronauts will dock with the gateway and rest a bit. They will then transfer to the Deep Space Transport, which looks like no other spacecraft in history. The spaceship and crew's quarters resemble a long pencil with an eraser at one end, which contains the capsule in which the astronauts will live and work. Along the pencil, there are a series of gigantic arrays of unusually long, narrow solar panels, so from a distance, the rocket begins to resemble a sailboat. While the Orion capsule weighs about 25 tons, the transport weighs 41. The Deep Space Transport will be their home for the next 2 years. This capsule is much bigger than the Orion and will give astronauts enough room to stretch a bit. This is important since they have to exercise daily to prevent muscle and bone loss, which could cripple them when they reach Mars. Once on board the Deep Space Transport, they will turn on the rocket's engines. But instead of being jolted by a powerful thrust and watching gigantic flames shoot from the back of the rocket, the ion engines will accelerate smoothly, gradually building up speed. Staring outside their windows, the astronauts will only see the gentle luminous glow of hot ions being steadily emitted from the ship's engines. The Deep Space Transport uses a new type of propulsion system to send astronauts through space, called solar electric propulsion. The huge solar panels capture sunlight and convert it to electricity. This is used to strip away the electrons from a gas, like xenon, creating ions. An electric field then shoots these charged ions out one end of the engine, creating thrust. Unlike chemical engines, which can only fire for a few minutes, ion engines can slowly accelerate for months or even years. Then begins the long, boring trip to Mars itself, which will take about 9 months. The main problem facing the astronauts is boredom, so they will have to constantly exercise, play games to keep alert, do calculations, talk to their loved ones, surf the web, etc. Other than routine course corrections, there's not much else to do during the actual voyage. Occasionally, however, they might be required to do some spacewalks in order to make minor repairs or replace worn parts. As the journey progresses, however, the time it takes to send radio messages to Earth gradually increases, eventually reaching about 24 minutes. This may prove a bit frustrating for the astronauts, who are used to instantaneous communication. As they gaze out their windows, they will gradually see the red planet come into focus, looming in front of them. Activity aboard the spaceship will rapidly quicken as the astronauts begin to make preparations. At this point, they will fire their rockets to slow their spacecraft down so they can gently enter into orbit around Mars. From space, they will see an entirely different panorama than seen on the Earth. Instead of blue oceans, green tree-covered mountains, and the lights of cities, they will see a barren, desolate landscape, full of red deserts, majestic mountains, gigantic canyons that are much larger than the ones on Earth, and huge dust storms, some of which can engulf the entire planet. Once in orbit, they will enter the Mars capsule and separate from the main spacecraft, which will continue to orbit the planet. As their capsule enters into the Martian atmosphere, the temperature will rise dramatically. But the heat shield will absorb the intense heat generated by air friction. Eventually, the heat shield will be ejected, and the capsule will then fire its retro rockets and slowly descend onto the surface of Mars. Once they exit the capsule and walk on the surface of Mars, they will be pioneers, opening up a new chapter in the history of the human race, taking a historic step toward realizing the goal of making humanity a multi-planet species. They will spend several months on the red planet before the Earth is in the right alignment for the return trip. This will give them time to scout the terrain, do experiments, such as looking for traces of water and microbial life, and set up solar panels for power. One possible objective might be to drill for ice in the permafrost, since underground ice may one day become a vital source of drinking water, as well as oxygen for breathing and hydrogen for fuel. After their mission is complete, they will go back into their space capsule and then blast off. Because of Mars's weak gravity, the capsule requires much less fuel than it would to leave the Earth. They will dock with the main ship in orbit, and then the astronauts will prepare for the 9-month journey back to the Earth. Upon their return, they will splash down somewhere in the ocean. Once back on terra firma, they will be celebrated as heroes who took the first step toward establishing a new branch of humanity. As you can see, we will face many challenges on the road to the red planet. But with the public's enthusiasm and with the commitment of NASA and the private sector, it is likely that we will achieve a manned mission to Mars in the next decade or two. This will open up the next challenge, to transform Mars into a new home. I think that when humans get around to exploring and building cities and towns on Mars, it will be viewed as one of the great times of humanity, a time when people set foot on another world and had the freedom to make their own world. Robert Zubrin. Chapter 5. Mars, the Garden Planet. In the 2015 movie The Martian, the astronaut, played by Matt Damon, faces the ultimate challenge: to survive alone on a frozen, desolate, airless planet. Accidentally left behind by his fellow crewmates, he has only enough supplies to last a few days. He must summon all his courage and know-how to last until a rescue mission can reach him. The movie was realistic enough to give the public a taste of the difficulties Martian colonists would encounter. For one, there are the fierce dust storms, which engulf the planet with a fine red dust that resembles talcum powder and almost tipped over the spacecraft in the movie. The atmosphere is almost entirely made of carbon dioxide, and the atmospheric pressure is only 1% that of the Earth, so an astronaut would suffocate within a few minutes if exposed to the thin Martian air, and his blood would begin to boil. To produce enough oxygen to breathe, Matt Damon has to create a chemical reaction in his pressurized space station. And since he is rapidly running out of food, he has to grow his own plants in an artificial garden. To fertilize the crops, he has to use his own waste. Bit by bit, the astronaut in The Martian takes the excruciating steps necessary to create an ecosystem on Mars that is capable of sustaining him. The movie helped to capture the imagination of a new generation, but the fascination with Mars actually has a long and interesting history that stretches back to the 19th century. In 1877, Italian astronomer Giovanni Schiaparelli noticed strange linear markings on Mars that seemed to be formed by natural processes. He called these markings canali, or channels. However, when the Italian was translated into English, the I was dropped, and the term became canals, which has an entirely different meaning. They are artificial, not natural. A simple mistranslation gave way to an avalanche of speculation and fantasy, sparking the Man from Mars myth. The wealthy, eccentric astronomer Percival Lowell began to theorize that Mars was a dying planet, and that the Martians had dug the canals in a desperate attempt to transport water from the polar ice caps to irrigate their scorched fields.